So I'm a bit curious as to the seating logic. You guys go to a rock concert, usually everyone tries to get up to the front, but it seems like the urinal rule is in effect here, where you kind of get evenly spaced out throughout the whole thing. There's plenty of room up at the front if you guys would like to come up and make it feel a little more friendly. I didn't think so. That was mostly a test. I know this industry well enough to know that nobody's going to budge. Good morning. My name is James Archer. I'm going to be your instructor for Villains 101, Scope Creep and Other Villains. When I'm not teaching at Web Design Superhero University, I'm also the operations director for 40, the finest web agency this side of the Rio Grande. If you're looking for Intro to Dreamweaver or Perl Level 3, those are down the hall. If you're going to be a web design superhero, you need to know about the villains that you're going to face, what their strengths and weaknesses are, and how you can conquer them. So that's what we're going to be talking about. So please pull out your university-issued iPhones, and we'll get started. The first villain that you guys are going to confront is Mr. Tessie McTesterson. He manifests himself as the sample data that you enter when you're doing a cursory test on your website before slinging it over to the client. Looks like it works well enough, so go ahead and submit it. What happens, though, is you wind up giving a whole lot of crap to your clients, and then they find all the problems and come back to you, and you go through endless cycles of trying to fix things. The magical way to defeat this guy is to actually sit down and methodically test your application. Doesn't have to be too difficult, but just make a plan to actually do some QA work and spend half an hour on it, bang through it, test some things that are not necessarily obvious. And if you ever get ambitious and want to defeat this guy finally, you can find him at 1234 North Main Street, any town. Let's move on to the next one. Now, this guy's just a jerk. This is the guy that so many of you guys are in competition with. And in fact, he may be among us somewhere. This is the guy that when you go up for a bit to bid on a website, looks reasonable, mid-size, pitch a couple grand on it. He comes in, says he'll do it for a couple $100, nails the job. The reason he nailed the job is because you didn't do an adequate job of explaining why you're charging what you charge. And if you do that, your clients will actually understand that there's quite a bit of difference. There's a huge range in the amount of work that web designers put into what they do. There are plenty of opportunities to do quite a bit of work, do just a little bit of work, but a client, their job isn't to understand web design and all those differences. So unless you explain them, they think they're getting the same thing for wildly different prices, and why wouldn't they go with the guy who can do it for $500? So if you want to take this guy out, all you've really got to do is plan ahead, think through what you're actually doing, understand your processes, and be able to explain those to your clients in a way that makes sense and justifies the expense. His major problem is that he can't really demonstrate any return on investment. He doesn't necessarily look at that from that perspective. He's just banging something out. So when you talk to your clients and explain that you're actually doing something that is going to make them more money, and the more they invest in it, the more they can get back from it, it makes a lot of sense, and they'll want to go ahead and put some money toward it. This guy's also a jerk, and he could be you. That's the scary part. The slave driver is all too common in this industry. He's the one that thinks it's perfectly normal to work a 60-hour work week. Just out of curiosity, how many of the students here are working roughly those hours? Bunch of slow hands going up. Okay. How many of you really enjoy working those hours? Not quite as many. What happens is that this guy sneaks into your life and just keeps squeezing you and squeezing you. And you just keep driving and driving until you're completely out of gas. And then you are unable to function at your peak performance levels. If you're a really great coder, working 60, 80 hours a week consistently will turn you into a really schlocky coder that could be replaced by pretty much anyone else. your brain just can't handle it for long periods of time, even when you think it can. The easy solution to this is to stop working those kind of hours and actually, you know, take a weekend off, take a vacation now and then, do some of those things. It's actually quite refreshing, and you come back and you're, bam, you're a genius again. You can go and knock stuff out of the park. One of the things to keep in mind is, because this has become so prevalent in our industry, it's, people have this perception that it's normal to work those hours. And if you don't work those hours, you're not really putting in enough effort. And I think it's almost the complete opposite. I think that if you're putting in 60-hour to 80-hour weeks, you're a really lousy project manager. There's no reason that a project can't be effectively and efficiently divided up into 40-hour work weeks, executed well, set the expectations with the client, take care of all that stuff. It's purely down to project management and expectation setting. There's no reason you can't do your job in a perfectly nice 40-hour work week, go home, watch some TV, get some sleep. And I'm hoping that some of you guys disagree with me, because we're going to have a nice Q&A session afterwards. I'm hoping you guys send some hardballs my way, and I'll have to defend these positions. Captain Innocent. This guy's not so much of a jerk. He's really nice, actually. He's very comfortable to be around. Feels like everything's going to be okay when it's not. How many people here have had some kind of really awkward server failure, loss of code, anything like that? Raise your hands. And I'm guessing that was a pretty miserable experience for you guys. I've lost plenty of stuff right at the last minute. Night before a site launches, I, you know, accidentally wipe out the entire database of content. You know, accidentally shut, you know, delete an account from our web server that was the wrong one, things like that. Over time, every single person in this industry will learn the value of version control backups, especially offsite backups, database backups. It seems like a chore now. It seems like you can get by. You're in a hurry. You got to get it launched, but it will always come back to bite you in the end if you don't. You will always have more time and misery invested if you don't do these things than if you do. They're not necessarily fun, but they're definitely worth doing. So I would strongly recommend that if you're not doing it already, make sure you're using offsite backups. Amazon S3 is a good way to do that. If you're doing code work, make sure you're using version control. So version's a good way to do that. And perhaps most of all, try to be machine independent. In our company, we strive hard to make sure that none of our data is dependent on any one particular machine. If I lose this laptop, I can just pull up your laptop and start working again within minutes. And we found that that's a very efficient way to run our company, because if anything crashes, we're not down. We have no downtime. And so we advise looking at a solution like that if you can. The intellectual property bot, model 1995. These are the clients that come and absolutely require an NDA for them to even ask you to take a look at their project. Or it's you requiring an NDA to talk to anyone about the project that you're trying to build because you want to collaborate with them or whatever it is you want to do. And the truth is, NDAs are really difficult and annoying. People just sort of use them as a reflex without thinking through it too much. But if you're a web designer and you just start haphazardly signing NDAs, you're tangling yourself in a whole lot of legal binding contracts that you then need to track and make sure that you're not violating. You know, one or two sounds fine, but you get 15 NDAs into it, you don't know what you can say anymore. You know, who knows what you can put in your portfolio? You got to go through and check each of those, and that gets to be a real pain in the neck. We have a general policy. We don't sign NDAs except under very extenuating circumstances. If, you know, the Department of Homeland Security came to us and needed us to do something, we'd probably sign an NDA for that. But for the most part, we just refuse to sign NDAs. And what happens is most of our clients say, oh, well, can you take a look at it anyway? And then we say, yeah, and we go ahead and do it. Now, if you yourself are working on the next great killer app and you think you know, someone's advised you need to have an NDA for anyone that's going to take a look at it, and your business plan is highly confidential and all that, all you've really done is make it really annoying for anyone who might want to collaborate with you. Someone you're asking for help, you're making them jump through a whole bunch of hoops and deal with a bunch of legal issues when it really doesn't matter that much. The NDA is not going to help you that much. And the truth is, you're not going to out hide your information to get successful. you can't beat people by keeping all your stuff tightly in like that. The only way you beat people is by out-executing them. It doesn't matter if other people know what your idea is. If you can out-execute them, you'll win every time. And like it says at the bottom, they can't steal it if you give it away. I think that this describes a lot of us in the industry. Who here is a freelancer or working on your own right now, or wants to be? That's a decent number of people. And it's actually very common because, you know, there are so many different things that are required to build a website that almost out of necessity, we all learn to do at least some of them. We kind of learn how to set up servers. We learn the design side. We learn the code side. We learn the software side of it. And eventually, we get ourselves convinced that we can do the whole thing really well on our own. And the truth is, we can. We think we can be a really efficient Swiss Army knife, but a Swiss Army knife is just a device that sucks at a whole lot of things instead of just one thing. Don't be that person. Learn to rely on other people. Learn to outsource stuff. Learn to bring people in to fill in the gaps that you have. If you're an excellent programmer, chances are you suck at marketing. If you're great at design, chances are your programming's not that great. There are a couple people that can hit a couple of them, but I mean, really just ask around, start meeting new people. There are people in this room who have different experiences than you do, different backgrounds. Get to know those people and start working with them on projects. It is possible to do a few things by yourself, but if you really break it down, the things that one person can knock out are going to suck in a lot of areas, just like a Swiss Army knife. On the other hand, you don't want to just gratuitously ramp up your company and start staffing positions that you really don't need. Once your business starts kicking in, and it's really not that hard, most web designers don't have a lot of trouble making ends meet. There's plenty of business out there. It's a thriving industry. If you're halfway competent and have some idea how to get your name out there, you're going to be swamped with work. Most of the people in this room are probably swamped with work. Nobody's complaining about how they have nothing to do. Everyone's complaining about how busy they are. So it's very tempting to just throw people at the problem. Start hiring in new designers, bring in contractors, just get whoever you can, all hands on deck, get them all to work on the project. And it's easy. I mean, we're in that mode right now of feeling like we've oversold. Now we have to just grab a bunch of people and get them in there, or we don't know what we're going to do. We don't know how we're going to finish these projects. But if we just start throwing people at the problem, it's going to cause a lot of issues for us later on. We're going to lose our company culture. We're going to lose our direction. We're going to have a whole bunch of people who aren't on the same page, all go in different directions, which is going to bring us pretty much nowhere. So the trick to defeating this particular villain is to ramp up slowly, hire strategically, wait until it really, really hurts, and you're very sure that you need to have someone, and you're sure that you've found the right person. Every once in a while, it won't work out, but you're going to save yourself a lot of pain and agony if you avoid the clone army issue. It can be very tempting to listen to this villain who will try to persuade you that you can just go ahead and get those really nice chairs, those extra computers, those big monitors, because they're a write-off, right? Write-off means it's free, right? It doesn't quite. There are tax benefits that you can get to doing things through your business and so forth. But a lot of new business owners don't look too much into it, don't necessarily get the advice of an accountant. And so they just start blasting through things, start buying what they think they need. Hey, if I have a really comfortable chair, it'll double my productivity, right? So why not spend a grand on that? The truth is that the best way to save money is to save money, not to buy things and call them write-offs. You know, as you're here, don't just go get, you know, the expensive dinners. Try and conserve your money. I mean, it's very hard to come by money in a business sometimes, even when you're very busy and very successful. So hang on to what you've got. You can sit on a folding chair for a while. I've been sitting on a folding chair at work. Ramp up when you need to ramp up, when you have the ability to do it. But, you know, don't just go out and spend money gratuitously. Hang on to it. It's hard-earned money. Keep it in the bank. It'll help you get through the difficult times. Being thrifty will bring a lot of benefit to you in the long run. The best way to get rid of this villain is to actually ask for justification. How is this going to benefit your business? How is this going to be worth the expense? How is your butt being a little more comfortable worth $1,000 It may be. And if it is, go ahead and buy the chairs. But if it's not, think through that issue and make sure you're challenging yourself on it before you kind of haphazardly make assumptions and run out and buy things that you probably don't need. Now, Jason Fried from 37 Signals would have you believe that if you do everything through email, your life's going to be glorious. There are great benefits to communicating with your team asynchronously. So you're not going over and tapping them on the shoulder and interrupting whatever they're doing and breaking them out of their flow so that they have to listen to you. However, that doesn't necessarily extend to your clients. Major Mailer would have you believe that you should do everything through email. Don't answer your phone. If you ignore their calls long enough, they'll email you, right? And then you can just handle it when you get to it, and you can star it and file it away in your GTD system, and it'll all be very efficient and nice. However, what happens is you get a very upset client. Not all clients like to email. Some of them are very verbal people. They like to communicate that way. That's how they express themselves. And what happens when you enforce asynchronicity in your business is that you get out of sync with your clients. The emails that you get don't necessarily reflect what they're really feeling and thinking. A lot of times people aren't very comfortable writing emails. You guys are all probably very competent at it, but your clients aren't necessarily. They're just used to tapping you on the shoulder and saying, hey, can you do this? Can you do that? I was thinking this. And when you get out of sync with your clients, you're losing a lot of potentially valuable information. What's going to happen is that you're going to miss red flags. You're going to miss clues of what they really want that would have saved you a lot of time and effort. You're going to miss the tone of their voice that lets you know how the project is really doing. So the way to get rid of this is to actually just call your clients. When your client calls you, call them back. If someone calls you asking for a job, call them right back. Pick up the phone even. If you're in the middle of coding, it sucks, but take a moment. Just pick up the phone because someone's trying to do something for you. Someone's giving you an opportunity. Every time that phone rings, it's an opportunity for you to further your business. And if you don't take advantage of that, you make a habit of not taking advantage of that and making other people jump through hoops so that you can be a bit more organized, you're going to lose a lot of potential business that way. And you're going to gain a lot of pain project management-wise from the issues that then come out of that. Now, we found that we've actually been very successful with our sales. And the thing we keep hearing from our clients is that we were the first one to pick up the phone. They called 10 people before us, which kind of feels bad for us, but you know, they call, and we were the first one that actually picked up the phone and talked to them and actually said something. So potentially we're getting your guys' work because you're not answering your phones. So answer your phones. If we don't get the work, that's great. You know, at least someone is. And then one of the worst of them all, the scope creep. How many people here have dealt with issues with their projects just sort of getting out of control? They don't know. That's probably the most painful one. It's a very common problem, and it's essentially a project management issue. And most of the people here probably don't consider yourselves project managers except as a secondary task to what you really like to be doing. And that's where sometimes it can be beneficial to collaborate with someone else. Maybe get someone in who's a business person, operations person, whatever. At our company, I've actually given up doing most of the design and software work that I used to do, and now I'm purely operations. That's all I do is essentially manage projects, manage clients, set expectations, and handle all of this kind of stuff that makes scope creep happen. For those who may not be familiar, scope creep is when the scope of your project, the actual definition of what you're doing, slowly but inevitably kind of hits entropy and just goes out of control. And the project you finish with is not even close to the project you started with. And it's an unfortunate epidemic that we allow this to happen habitually. Almost everyone here has themselves allowed it to happen. And you don't often see it when it's happening. So what you have to do is be very vigilant. You have to watch your projects. You have to watch the scope. When you see those expectations starting to change, when a client says, hey, can we just add this in? It's going to take like 5 minutes, right? It shouldn't, you know, not a problem. And you say, I can probably knock that out. Go ahead and add that in. And then you do it 50 times over. And then you make a bunch of other changes. And then the client decides they don't like the design, so you change the design. Then you change the software. And then you're using Expression Engine instead of WordPress. And then you add this new feature. And then, on top of it all, the client's yelling at you. Why is this project taking 3 months? It was supposed to take 4 weeks when we originally talked about it. So you notice that the time expectation doesn't change. And as far as they know, the scope expectation hasn't changed because it's all happened a little bit at a time. It just creeps, just a little bit. So the way to get rid of that is twofold. One, actually define what the scope of the project is. Up front, say, I'm going to do this. Now, you don't have to stick with that. In fact, it doesn't make a lot of sense to stick with that. And, you know, there are probably some people here, developers who follow, you know, maybe agile methodologies or so forth, they're very familiar with this. Set something up front, give the price for that piece of work, and then as those changes start to come in, immediately raise crap about it. So just say, whoa, we need to talk about this. It's fine if they want to make a change. That's great. And, you know, look at the change, decide if it's valid. If it is, give them a quote on what it's going to take to add that in. Even if it's just a time quote, even if you want to throw it in for free, just say, just so you know, this is going to add 4 days to the project. You can't do something in no time. We tend to think that we can and that we can add in this piece or that piece and it will add somehow no time to our project. But it always does add time, so add that time and add a buffer because you suck at estimating. I suck at estimating. We all suck at estimating. So if you think it's going to take 2 days, tell them 5 days. That's going to add 5 days to the project. And that gives you a little bit of cush time for, you know, when you have a fight with your girlfriend and then you can't code that night and you got to, you know, whatever it is. It's going to make your life quite a bit more beneficial, and you actually get rid of the scope creep. The second part is just enforcing it. Make sure that you are firm when you say it will take 5 more days. I can't add that in for zero time. And if it is anything significant, even add cost to it, even a nominal cost. Make sure that there's documentation, there's some kind of a simple change order, even if it's just an email that you can look back on and see, you know, when they start yelling at you 3 months later and say, why isn't my project done? You can say, well, it's because of these 17 requests that I had. And if you add up all the estimates I gave you, it comes to 3 months. And usually what happens is your clients say, oh, all right, if these are things I asked for and you already told them and that's what it adds up to, fine. Because you've set the expectation with the client. The problem isn't that it took 3 months. The problem is that you let them think it was going to take a few weeks when it didn't. As long as you're continually updating your estimates and continually setting those expectations, you'd be surprised how long a project can drag on and the client's still perfectly happy. It could be 9 months down the road as long as you've let them know throughout the process when to expect it. Now, this is a particularly nasty villain. Almost every web designer that I've met, every web developer, every programmer, seems to have firmly the idea in their head that they've got all these side projects going, and one of them is going to achieve that glorious day when they don't have to do client work anymore. How many people here have something going that they're hoping is going to get them out of there? At least a few of them, and then most of them aren't admitting. Okay. But it seems like everyone's got something that's going to get them out of it. Now, the problem is those ideas don't stop. They keep coming. When you're in the industry, you're watching the things together, you're a smart guy, you can put pieces together. And what happens is you wind up with all these side projects that you hardly had time for one, let alone 50 of them. But you keep doing these things, keep knocking them out. And so, I mean, if you're like us, you probably have 50 half-finished projects going on at any given time. And some of them may be great, but because you're not actually giving adequate time to any of them, nothing's really happening. So what I'd strongly recommend is categorize them, put them into, you know, okay, really good, really great, and then take all of them and just file them away in a book and just don't worry about them. And the one that keeps coming back, maybe you work on that one. If it keeps coming back over and over again, you can't get it out of your head. What'll tend to happen is that those great ideas will tend to sit in the file. You know, they don't come back because they're not a common pain that you have. They're not something that, you know, really, really strikes you as a good idea. It was just sort of a passing inspirational moment of creativity, which is great. It's good to have those, but just jot them in a book, file them away for later. Maybe come back to them at some point. But keep your mind as clear as possible, focus on the things that you're doing, and pick a lane. Pick one thing and really go at it. Get it done, push it hard, market it. The problem a lot of times with the you know, if you're building a web app or something like that, the problem isn't that it won't be successful. It's that you're not pushing it hard enough to be successful because, you know, you try it out for a week and nobody signs up and so you abandon it and move on to something else. Pick something really good, make it very good, and push hard at it. Now, the last villain is the most interesting one. because he's sort of your man on the inside. He can be turned. Doesn't have to be a villain. If you do the right things, you might actually pull this off to where he's an ally of yours and can help you defeat all these other things. Already here, I've heard all kinds of complaining about client work. People are on their laptops, but people are probably on their laptops right now dealing with client issues, writing back to clients, working on client projects. I was doing it in a panel yesterday. I was like, oh, great. Client stuff come up. Now I got to, you know, sit and do this instead of actually paying attention to this really interesting panel. But our clients are the ones that let us do the things that we love to do. They are the best people in our lives. Without our clients, we've got nothing. We're just working in cubicles somewhere, plodding away, making money for someone else. If you really want to be a web design superhero, you've got to learn to love your clients. And you've got to learn to turn them too, so that they're not your enemies. They can be if you're not careful. But you can turn them. You can help them. They want to help you. They just don't know how. They're not familiar with the things that you need. So educate them. Teach them. Help them. Coach them. Help them to become the good clients that you really, really want. And they will be. They want to be. They have nothing against you. They want, you know, the project to work out. They don't want it to be delayed. So if it's going to be delayed, help them help you not make it delayed. And they're there. They want to give you their money. They want to give you their time. They want to let you do the things that you love to do. So give them that opportunity and show them the respect that they need to be able to do that. I think that we should have a lot of respect for our clients. And that's something that we're working on as well. But, I mean, they're the ones that make all this stuff possible. And it's worth giving them a little benefit of the doubt for that. So that's what I've got as far as the formal presentation. And so what I'd like to do now is have a little bit of a Q&A session about some of these villains, maybe some of your experiences with them, and any other problems that you guys might be looking to figure out how to defeat from a business perspective. Our agency has been fairly successful over the last number of years, and we've learned a lot of painful things that we're more than happy to share. We have no secrets. Anything you want to know about our business, we're more than happy to share. So the microphone back there in the middle is on. I hope that you guys will... come up and let me know what you're thinking, share your experiences, and let's see what we can learn.
All right. So I think we've got all the villains taken care of in my shop except for the scope creep. And so I have some questions kind of to you and generally too.
Sure.
But the some of the problems we're having with scope creep is that we're spending either way too much time on documentation or we're spending not enough time so we have these little holes that in our documentation that end up adding up to scope creep or arguments over, not arguments, but discussions over who's paying for what or is this scope creep or was this in the original spec. The time that it takes to manage the scope creep, especially for high maintenance clients, same thing goes for those clients that you want to educate, and we do take the time to do that, but that adds up too. So those are some of the things that we're dealing with.
Sure.
Specifically with scope creep. That is not, you know, the major problem. It's just the sum of the parts.
Now, tell me a bit about this documentation. What kind of documentation is this?
Documentation and communication, really. Everything starting from the initial meeting to the contract to kind of the spec sheets.
So basically all that ugly project management type stuff.
Exactly. Down to emails and phone conversations.
Well, I think there are probably two problems in play there. The first problem might be over-documentation. You know, it may be that you're writing lengthy proposals when there could be a way to kind of tighten that up. Your specs could probably be simpler. When we spec out a project, even a fairly large web project as far as the proposal, we keep it pretty simple. I mean, a definition of a particular tool or piece of code in there may just have one brief paragraph, two, three sentences in there that explains this piece will do this. You know, within that, we've got some flexibility to, you know, make some different things happen. And in some cases, depending on your project, a client may need very specific and explicit documentation as you go through that process. A lot of people here would probably argue that you don't, and it's better to just sort of iterate and kind of make it up as you go to some extent. But the second problem is not necessarily that you're spending too much time on documentation, but just that you didn't allot enough time for documentation in the beginning. So watch what you do. Watch the statistics of what you do. Say, you know, if you look at a project and you say, man, we spent 20 hours on documentation for this project, that's not a problem. That may be great. That documentation could be what makes you guys you and makes your clients love you. But account for that 20 hours next time. You know, give yourselves the time to do that. And if you find that, you know, just measure yourselves and take those into account, because we're all really bad at estimating. I can tell you, everyone in this industry is very bad at estimating, including myself. So don't try to be good at estimating because you can't be, but try and replace your off the cuff estimates with actual numbers that are measured and that you have some documentation for, and then just pad them so that you have a buffer in there.
Yes, a question about clients. Some clients are a lot of fun. Some clients have big budgets, hopefully together, but rarely.
Yes.
We have a lot of cool, fun clients with good causes that just don't have a lot of money. And we like to work with them. We just have to, you have to constantly rein them in. You can't afford this kind of site. You can't afford to print this. How do you guys handle that? Do you try to weed those people out? Do you keep one or two around? Zero? How do you break it to them that constantly break it to them they can't afford that?
We essentially try to show them what all is involved in it, because there's a lot involved in it. We try and show them, but a lot of times what we try and do is really boil it down to why. Why do you need this piece of functionality? Well, if it's going to, you know, say it's a nonprofit and there's some community area that they read about in the magazine, they totally want to have a, you know, community area with tags and all profiles and all that good stuff. Well, why? What is that actually going to do to your business? And kind of demand that information. When they come back and say, well, we think it's really going to, you know, increase our donations. Well, if you can really increase your donations, that's worth something, right? So what is that worth? Well, okay, well, then you're starting to get toward an actual, you know, a return on investment there. If there is no return on investment, then again, the question, why? It's very cool, but you don't need it, so cut it out. The other trick is that we found that the less people pay for projects with us, the more of a nightmare they are. The more we try to do a favor,
same here.
Yeah. The more they hate us for it. And, yeah. And we will just get relentlessly punished when we try to do people favors. So in some ways, when we charge money, it's not because we're hungry for money. We're usually doing all right. Because it gets them to sort of respect the project and what's happening and makes them think about it a bit more. When it's free, they don't have to think about it and they can just ask for whatever they want. If they're paying for it, they have some respect for the process and you can kind of talk them through that project. Now, what you can do, you know, especially with a nonprofit, a lot of times is do it for a reduced price and consider part of that potentially a donation to them, which may then later be a tax write-off or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely some kind of inverse scale of high maintenance, low payoff.
We have found it to be such the case that we literally refuse to do any free project for anyone, even our mothers.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, one of our guys had his mother come and say, hey, guys, can you just help me out with this really simple site? And the answer was, no, we can't, because you will hate us by the time we're done with this project, even though we're doing it because we're doing it for free. And so we just flat out refuse to do it because it never works out. It never benefits them and it never benefits us.
Yeah. One more before I sit down. You mentioned education, and that seems to be the answer to my first question, is you got to educate the smaller clients. Do you educate all your clients? Does it ever backfire? Do you let them in on like, oh, that's a Photoshop filter. It'll take 2 minutes. No, that's code writing. It's going to take 4 days. Always let them know the difference. Does it ever bite you later?
Essentially, we try to take it slowly with all of our clients. We have to kind of wing it sometimes. You know, I mean, some different clients have different levels of being savvy, and some people just kind of pick it up. But what we found is that the people we think are savvy aren't necessarily. They may just be in the habit of sounding that way. So we try to just take every client slowly, walk them through the process, explain what we're doing. I know you're in a hurry, but let's talk through this to make sure we get it right the first time. And really just kind of go through the process, handhold them through there, and usually it'll work out just fine. Yes.
Hi. I was just wondering, what advice do you give to someone who, say, has a full-time job, does freelance, can't quite say no to clients that email them on the side and be like, you know, I really want you to do this. I've heard of you through word of mouth, but you just have way too much on your plate and...
Quit your job.
Yeah. I've heard that before.
Well, there's a reason you've heard it before. There's I mean, really, if you're halfway good at what you do, getting work's not really a problem. And if you quit your job, then you have to do it, and so you will.
Yeah.
So when I first started this agency, I was married. We just bought a house. We just had our first baby. We had two car payments, and it was almost Christmas, and I had no clients lined up. So I had no choice. The business was going to be successful. And so I quit my job, walked out. Next day, got a client, and just started taking off from there. This year, we're looking to do probably $500,000 worth of work because I quit my job at that very awkward situation.
Yeah,
so I'm just go ahead, quit the job.
Well, the other problem is that I have a hard time trusting other people, and where I live, there aren't a lot of people doing the same kind of work.
So move somewhere
really,
else.
It's hard to.
There are simple solutions to seemingly difficult problems.
Well, here's another general one. What about friends mm-hmm. who want you, friends or other clients who want you to do something for them web-wise? You don't necessarily want to charge your friends a lot of money because it's worth, you know, you're doing a lot for them. You have a lot of ideas.
Charge them like regular clients and treat them like regular clients. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the business stuff, there are no friends when it comes to web projects. Because when you do, you get into the favor zone. And when you're in the favor zone, then when they ask for scope increases, there's nothing to come back on because you're not charging them. So there are no friends. If a friend comes to you and says, you know, I need a site that you would normally charge $2,000 for or $5,000 for, charge them $2,000 or $5,000. I say, hey, this is going to be great to work with you. I'm really looking forward to it. I think we can do some things here. It's a good idea, but it's going to cost this much. And hey, explain the reasons for that. You know, explain that when you do favors, it's going to work out really ugly. It's going to damage your friendship more. Keep it really simple and just charge your standard rates. Yeah. We've tried a couple times, and it's dicey. It's possible sometimes, depending on the friend, but it is dicey. And I would just recommend someone else to him. Just say, hey, you know, I recommend you go with this guy. He could probably do it a little cheaper than I can. Yes.
I think that we have with the clients is we control scope creep very well. We do typically do pretty large strategy projects. You know, in the $30,000-$40,000 range that are very thick.
Mm-hmm.
I think the issue comes more internally with our programmers, you know, as they're reading through the documentation and programming, say, hey, I think I want to add this in, and they start programming it differently and then end up programming themselves into a corner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just wondering if you've had experience with that and kind of how you manage that, because it seems like it's happened on a few different projects, and instead of learning from mistakes, it's just kind of a continuous.
Then fire them. If they, you know, the first time it happens, advise them. The second time it happens, admonish them. And the third time it happens, fire them. You know, if they're going to consistently do things that damage your company, you don't want them in there. So just find programmers that will kind of adapt and pick up the clues you're dropping.
Okay, easy enough.
I had some advice for you on the scope creep. If you can get it, my magic bullet was charging hourly. It was in my project agreements, and I have the clients that will do it, and it's the same rule as the more you charge, the more they appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the one client, which, you know, that's the issue. But with that one client, the appreciation runs so much deeper, and I even will do the crazy hacks. I tell them up front, I'm like, yeah, you want this tomorrow? Here are the implications of it. You know my hourly rate, you get charged for it. But then the other aspect of it is when you want to change something next week because something else changed, it's going to take three times as long to fix because we didn't do it right. And what I found is they really appreciate it. So that was my solution for that. If you can find them and get them to do that, that's the client to hold on to, and they are your best ally because they really start to appreciate you.
So. And there are a lot of pros and cons to hourly work, and it's a, you know, it will be a debate 100 years from now, let alone right
sure.
now. So, but it depends the, you know, the nature of what you're doing, the nature of the client, and the nature of your goals for the business.
Exactly.
And it hourly work is the safest way to do it because if you put in an hour, you get paid for the hour.
Yep.
So that, you know, if that's what you look for, that is an excellent solution.
And it means trust too, because you don't have to, if you have to justify every single hour with 15 minutes of documentation for how you spent the hour, dump the client, you need something else. But if they trust you, they're not going to question you on every single minute. And so that's why I said, if you can do it, you've got the clients who will pay for it, it works. The question I had was, you were talking about appreciating clients. The problem is, what is your advice for blowing off steam within the company when you get the ridiculous questions repeatedly, or the client that 5 minutes
like I did yesterday?
Or 5 minutes before close time, why isn't this working? I've told you about 15 million times. That's not our project. We help you with that, you know, explain whatever it is. I mean, so it's like we need to blow off steam within the company, mm-hmm. but I find myself at the same time as the owner and everything trying to reinforce to them, but I love her.
Yes.
I really do. I honestly have an affection for this woman that I hate sometimes when she calls at 5 till with a stupid question because she pays the bills.
Yeah.
So it's like, how do you do that without me having to do that? Because as my company grows, I don't want to have to go around to every single one of them and say, okay, let's have a bitch session, and then let me tell you why you should appreciate them because they're paying your salary.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, the situation that we are in as sort of authorities within an industry, we are essentially their mom or dad, and we are their parent. We need to, in a lot of ways, treat them like a parent. You know, when your kid does something dumb, and then they do it again, and then they do it again, and then they do it again, you can't fire them.
Right.
You know, now, in certain cases, we do have that luxury, you know, under extenuating circumstances with clients. If you need to get rid of them, get rid of them. But generally speaking, when they call up at 5 till with the same question that they've said over and over again, you say, well, you know, that's actually not our project. And just say the same thing that you said 15 times over. And if you find a different way to say it that makes more sense or whatever, just go ahead and say it. Keep it calm. Keep it, you know, impersonal, unemotional. Just be polite with them, and then just let it go, and then just punch your wall over and over and over again.
Well, I was going to say with the employees. That's the real problem. Is it's like, how to make sure they don't lose respect for the people who are bringing in money at the same time. I want to let them blow off steam.
There's always going to be a certain amount of frustration with it, but I think it's just it's almost a culture issue. It's a matter of reminding them that, you know, hey, these guys are the reason that you have your job. They don't know the things that you know. They have trouble remembering. And just like you would have trouble remembering something that's in a completely different area. You know, when you're in biology class in school, it made perfect sense to the teacher, but it was just, you know, went over your head. The client's dealing with the same thing. They're going to ask some dumb questions over and over again. And just welcome the dumb questions. That's just, you know, it's just part of the game.
I noticed that you put your Twitter name on there. And I follow you on Twitter. And I recommend everybody else.
How's it going, Brian?
He didn't pay me to do that. I surprised him with that. So a lot of the advice, it's very like common sense kind of stuff. It sounds simple. It sounds like, yeah, that makes sense. But most of these things, they're common mistakes. Everybody, you know, comes across this and they go down the wrong path. Do you have any like recommended definitive like guides for here are all the simple things that you should keep in mind, like don't take, you know, certain projects based on this.
We're still working on that list. So we're putting together a list for our business of simple one-line things. And I recommend this. Keep a logbook of, you know, whenever you hit one of those situations where it's like, geez, we're not doing that again, write that down so you remember not to do that again. You know, and you don't want to build up a lot of scar tissue and have this massive book of, you know, all these clients suck, we're not going to do any of this stuff. But, you know, if something's genuinely a bad business process or a bad way to approach a situation or a good way to approach a situation, jot that down and just kind of let that become part of your company policy and company culture. I don't think there's any really good existing list necessarily, at least I haven't seen one. There may be one out there, and if you guys are aware of it, shoot me an email, but you know, generally, we're just trying to learn as we go. You know, when we figure out, we don't do websites for friends and family, write that down. And when new people come in, introduce them to the company culture, walk them through that process and be like, here are the things we've learned. You know, just so you know, you may agree or disagree with them for various reasons. And we can talk about that when the time's appropriate. But generally, this is the way we do things because we learn from experience. And just kind of keep that log yourself and, you know, share it with other people too. I mean, that's what we're trying to do. We've, you know, learned a lot of these things the hard way, and we're just trying to share it so you guys can hopefully dodge some of these issues. Now, chances are within the next week, you're going to go ahead and do about 5 of these, but that's just the nature of the industry. You got to do them over and over again, and hopefully this will at least make you aware of them as you're doing them.
Hi, James. Actually, I wanted to bring up some commentary on the client being your greatest ally. One of the biggest problems is that a lot of people, especially in the consulting, the contract business, will go through a project, they'll finish, and their relationship with the client ends. And people don't understand that if you want your client to be your greatest ally, it's a lot of work. you're there for them constantly. You're keeping in touch. You're maintaining those relationships. The company I work for now, before we had an in-house design team, we actually worked with a group that's doing a great presentation here at South by Southwest, the Blue Flavor Group. They still keep in touch with us. It makes all the difference in the world because whenever we, if we ever get overstaffed or we get too many projects or something goes wrong, the first people that we turn to is the people that helped us before. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to get, if you want to get your client in the corner, in your corner, you need to actually maintain an active relationship. You need to check in on them. You need to see what's up. You need to make sure that you see them if they're going to be at events or something like that. Take the time, get involved, and put a lot of effort into it because you get it back tenfold.
I hugely agree with that. That is an excellent point. You know, when we had a client that recently launched a restaurant, so we did their restaurant website. We were the first people served in that restaurant. You know, we just had another client come back to us. They were the first client that we ever took on after we launched the business. And they came back, they're coming back to us. You know, when we first did it, it was a $300 website. This was way back in the day when I was freelancing. It's now a $7,500 website that they're coming back to us because the first website built their business so well. Now it's time to kind of come back and update because we stayed in touch with them. So I strongly recommend that. And I strongly recommend doing it at a personal level, not through, I mean, newsletters are good. Mailers are good. Christmas cards are good, but that's not going to do the job. You need to call them up personally and say, hey, you know, I haven't talked to you in a couple months, but I was just looking through your Google Analytics and happened to notice this. You know, I thought you might be interested to know that a lot of your traffic's coming from this and, you know, kind of walk them through that process and just keep in touch with them. Let them know you still care about them. You're still thinking about them and you still want to do stuff with them. And maybe you don't even charge for that. They could go years in between that, but a few minutes a month for each client can make a massive difference. And that can mean you're their rock star. As opposed to you're some guy who did something for them a long time ago, and when they need someone else, they'll just find someone else. So that's an excellent point. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I was just going to add, you mentioned that some people email too much and forget to call. Also visit. I noticed yes. When I worked for other bosses, the boss would go to corporate to meet with Susie and Bill and Ted, and James would grab them too, and you get jobs from them. And mm-hmm. Now I notice it with us, my partner and I. You go to the office. As soon as people see you, they're like, oh, yeah, him. What does he do? What can I do with him? You go pick up one job, you come back with three. And this goes for corporate accounts, not a one-man client. But
yeah, because you're building familiarity and you're building trust. You know, when you email with someone and they do something for you, you build sort of a very elemental level of trust of, I contacted him and he did something. But when you've seen them, you've talked to them in person, they've been in your building, you've been in their building, you've touched them, you've shaken their hands, they've seen you, they smelled you, hopefully not, but you know, it builds that human bond there that just creates this intrinsic trust. And that's part of the reason on our website, you know, we put our portfolio, we put our personal profiles, we have big photos of us, even though none of us want our photos on that website. When we see a client for the first time, they already have some trust. They recognize us. And that recognition and familiarity and comfort that they have is what will make them come back to you later on, as opposed to just going with someone else because you're just some guy. So that's a great point. Thank you.
Will you talk a little bit about your process for defining scope and when you have the actual acquisition of the client, when you actually write the budget, when you rewrite the budget because you actually discover what the scope of the project is, mm-hmm. how you do that?
We, in a lot of cases, I think we have enough experience that we've been able to kind of identify common scenarios. And so when we come into a client, we kind of look at them, we interview them, we have a questionnaire we ask them to fill out to make sure that we remember to ask them the relevant questions. But really, there are only a few pieces of information you need to know, and then it's your job as a designer of that solution to figure out what it is. So one thing we don't do is ever ask the client what they want. And if they start to tell us what they want, we stop them. So we say, explain the context of your business, explain your competitive landscape, explain your goals for the business, what it is you're trying to accomplish, and specifically, what are you trying to accomplish with this website? If we have those pieces of information, that's it. I don't care if they want tagging or whatever. We don't need to know that. That's our job to figure out a solution for their problem. That's why they brought us in. So essentially what we do is we come in, then we identify internally what that solution is. We explain that to them, and we have sort of a buy-in on it that we then write it out in a bit more detail with a bit of scope attached to it. You know, we'll build this feature that will do this, that feature that will do that. Our scope probably maxes out at about, you know, usually it's going to be one page maybe, Probably maxes out at about 3 pages for a pretty substantial application. And that, you know, we just tend to write that up. And what we do is, if that document, that initial proposal, ever ceases to be true, so if we look back and they've asked us to take something out and replace it with something else, then that piece of the text ceases to be true. And that's the point that we go in to say, just so you know, this changes what we have agreed to. So we need to essentially renegotiate, even if it doesn't make an actual change in price. We need to renegotiate and say, okay, this is the new scope of work, and we'll revise the wording and send that back to them and get that approved. And then at that point, get any kind of change in money or whatever that needs to happen. Sure. It doesn't. We're the orange. And you should be too. There should be no apples to apples comparison. Anytime you are making a pitch to someone, your goal is not to show that you're the same as the other people that are pitching. You are completely different. And you need to just pound into them, you are the only person who can provide XYZ, whatever that is. You know, whether it's, you know, customer service or this development methodology or that approach or whatever it is, you're the only person who can do that. And you should never treat it as an apples to apples situation. Yes.
You mentioned estimation of work, and I saw a lot of nodding, or misunderestimation, I guess, of work.
Uh-huh.
What advice do you offer? Because I know it. So in my company, we don't have external clients. We do work for our internal business units.
Uh-huh.
And every time we do estimation of work and it's underestimate, they get angry. They're like, I don't understand why you guys can't estimate. And you know, you mentioned that we're bad at it, and it's true. So how do you get around that?
I think the problem is, I don't know if anyone saw Jim Kudal's talk yesterday, but he expressed it pretty well. And the problem is that we don't know how long it's going to take until it's taken that long. You know, I mean, sometimes the solutions are easy, sometimes they're hard, but we're dealing with difficult issues, design issues, software issues, whatever it is. These are difficult problems, and we're kind of coming at them and figuring them out on the fly and doing the best we can with them. So at best, we're just making a wild-ass guess as to how long it's going to take us. Now, with past experience, we can get some basic metrics. You know, if someone comes to us and wants a content management system implemented with a custom design on it, well, we've done 10 of those, so we have some idea that it's basically this range. And so we can kind of give them a decent estimate. Now, if we can't do that, sometimes what we'll do is break it into phases. We'll say, okay, what's the bare minimum we need? Let's price that out, do that, and then we'll focus on phase two, and we'll have learned enough by then to kind of scope that piece out accurately. So if it's big or weird, try and break it up into little pieces and do it that way. Yes.
Hey. What do you do when a client asks for something that's a really, really bad idea, and it's a bad idea?
We tell them no.
Really?
Yeah. Like if we say no, we won't do that because it's very bad for your business.
And if they just refuse to accept all the professional advice and they just demand to have animated GIFs on their homepage, and you know it's just the worst idea in the world, but they, you know, it's a huge client of yours, for example, and you know you don't want to say no to them. I mean, a lot of the project managers at my company have a really hard time saying no despite all of our advice. So, I mean, yeah. How do you handle that?
That's a very difficult problem. That's one that we confront fairly regularly because it does happen pretty often. The first thing we do is say no, and we explain very clearly no. And we also make a note to ourselves that we really sucked at explaining why we do what we do beforehand. So, you know, really we should have laid the groundwork in the kickoff meeting that we're the authorities in this. You're paying us to come up with these things for you and to stop you from doing dumb stuff. And you're now in the process of doing dumb stuff. So, we make a note to ourselves that we blew it on that time. We need to make sure we solve that the next time around. The second thing we do is we sit down with them. I mean, we make a big deal of it. We say, okay, we need to meet in person and go through this because this is an issue. You know, you're asking us to do something we know is wrong. We need to sit down and talk through this. And it's really an issue of you haven't yet made them understand why it's wrong. Now, every once in a while, you're just going to get a relentless client that is just, you know, their head's so far up there that they just have to have it that way or their head's going to explode. And that being the case, you have two options. You can go ahead and do it and let them know you're doing it under protest. This is a really bad idea, but you know, whatever, if this is what you want to do, we can go ahead and do it, but know that this is going to change the tone of our relationship. You know, we are no longer your advisors necessarily. We're just your production team. And we personally will treat that like we're your production team now. We will, you know, we're not going to put so much time into giving you advice, and they need to know that up front. Because that probably is what will happen. You know, it'll be like, these guys are jerks, so let's just knock it out and get it out. So if that's the case, that's fine, but let them know you're doing that just to be ethically sound with them. The other option you have is just to refuse to do the work. And if you have to fire the client, fire the client. And if you have to fire the project manager that won't fire the client, fire the project manager.
I work in an agency too. And just to follow up on that last point, it happened. I mean, we always try and say no, you know, when we think something really, you know, is just a stupid idea. There's this one long-standing client that we had, and really they were insistent, we really want to do this, we really want to do this. And we're like, you know, eventually we gave in. And it turns out what we did, you know, we did the best job we possibly could on that feature that we thought was stupid. That feature has turned into the most useful thing on the site.
And it happened.
So, you know, like, don't necessarily, you know, accept the fact maybe that you're not always 100% right. And if you can take a really crappy idea and do a good job with it, that might be, you know, that might help you out.
That's true. So. That's an excellent point. I mean, everyone here should be willing to be wrong pretty frequently and pretty fast. I mean, at best, I mean, if you're really good at what you do, you'll probably be right about 70% of the time. So make sure you keep that in mind and kind of be a little bit flexible. Now, there are two important things to remember. I think the first one is that, like Jacob pointed out, we have ongoing relationships with our clients. So it doesn't have to be perfect right out of the gate. You know, if you have to give a little bit, to, you know, if you can get it 75% awesome and 25% client, well, that's okay. You can come back and advise them on some of those changes later on in the relationship, you know, having a retainer plan or whatever. And the other important part is that, you know, sometimes just do the best you can, because a lot of times the things that we're very much prima donnas about, and it's absolutely cannot, you know, we can't have the weather on the homepage because that's so idiotic and cliche, ultimately is going to make very little business difference to them. It's not, their business isn't going to suddenly fail because there's a weather widget on their homepage. You know, and the things that are critically important to us as experts in our field, most people don't care about. So sometimes we just let stuff slide and it's not going to make that much of a difference. So I think as long as we remember those two things, we'll be in pretty good shape. So how are we doing on time here? Looks like we're just about done. Are there any, we probably have time for one last question if anyone's got one burning but hadn't gotten up yet. Okay, well, good. Go anyway.
All right, so we position our company to be oranges instead of trying to be apples to apples. But one thing we get a lot of times is we do a lot of the pre-work, you know, educating our client. But a lot of times we get, well, exactly how do you come up with your estimates?
Mm-hmm.
And we have a couple standard answers that we give, but I'd be interested in if you got in those situations and what.
Yeah, typically we just tell them that it's based on experience. You know, we value the work we do, so we tell them we're not going to be the cheapest one, and it is more expensive to hire us than to hire someone who can be really cheap, like Mr. Lowball up there. But they get a lot of benefit from that. I mean, the difference between hiring someone who doesn't know what they're doing and someone who does is essentially no result versus some result. They want some result, so hire someone who knows what they're doing. The second part is just it's based on experience. We've done a lot of projects. We know how long it's going to take to do this. You know, whether you guys know it right now, it is going to take that long. And you'll have people come in and say, you know, when we come in and say it's going to be 3 months and $20,000, you're going to have people telling you it's 4 weeks and $2,000. But by the time you get done with them, it will be, you know, 6 months and $30,000, whatever. So explain to them that process. Walk them through and say there are a lot of people in this industry who they don't know how to estimate. They think they're going to price really low, but then it's project's going to go out of control and they're going to charge a lot for it. The price we give you is the price we give you. That will be the final price for the project. And just let them know that. And if they're comfortable with that, great. And if they're not, let them go with lowball. And then like many of our clients, and this happens to us a lot, 6 months later, they'll come back to us and then hire us. And that happens very frequently. We landed three or four clients this month who were people we bid on 6 months ago and went with someone else. And now they're coming back to have us actually do what we said we were going to do. So hang in there. All right. Well, thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate you coming by. We'll probably have a bunch of people rushing in now who thought it was 10 o'clock when it wasn't.